So let's get into this. The big story of the last few days has been this mass shooting in Moscow, which was not just a shooting, it was a terror attack. It was four gunmen shooting up the concert hall. They set off some explosives. It caused the roof to cave in. It was really bad. The numbers we have now, and the numbers kept getting revised upwards over the last few days. So the number that I'm at right now, and this could still go up a little bit, is 134 dead from this attack, 134 dead Russians, and more than 100 who have been injured from this quote-unquote ISIS attack on a concert hall in Moscow. From what we know now, 11 men were involved in the attack. They've been detained, four of which were the people shooting up the building. So four of them were gunmen, the other seven were involved in other various ways. The attackers shot up the concert hall, the detonated bombs caused the fire, it caused the roof to cave in. This was a really bad, or I guess in the case of if you're a terrorist, a really successful attack, you know? But if you're a normal person, this is a really, really bad thing that has just happened. And of course, that means that the pro-Ukraine side isn't necessarily normal people, but we knew that from the beginning. They're celebrating and cheering this attack on Russia, blissfully ignorant of the fact that something similar could happen in the United States. And I'll talk about that after I cover the facts of this story. Four dudes with guns shot up a concert hall in Moscow and killed 134 people. And that's just really, really bad. That's just really, really bad. Because when you think of mass shootings in the United States, we are every bit as vulnerable. We're every bit as vulnerable. And think, Russia is at war, right? They're at war. Now, they don't consider themselves to be at war yet, but Moscow's been hit with drones. They've had Ukrainian attacks into Belgorod. Like, they've had minor incursions into their own territory throughout the war. Like, so they're as primed to defend themselves as they're going to be. And yet, this slipped through the cracks. Now you have people like Peter Zion saying, oh, it's a sign of Russia's incompetence. No, it's really not. It's a sign of what happens the second you let your guard down to people who really don't care about your humanity. Right? Because ISIS, specifically ISIS-K, you know, the same ISIS that waltzed into Afghanistan magically after the Taliban took over, and haven't heard much from them since. ISIS-K apparently has taken credit for the attack. They've published a video that was filmed by the people shooting up the concert hall, so there's a little bit of credibility there, as Alexander of the Duran pointed out. But that's not all. You see, these people, according to Russia, had connections in Ukraine. Now, why do I say that? Putin, after the attack, he claimed that Ukraine was involved in the attack, saying that the attackers, when they were done with the concert hall, they were moving towards the border with Ukraine. And according to Russian intelligence, there were preparations that were being made on the Ukrainian side of the border to receive these attackers. You know, he said a window was being prepared to be opened for them, right? So they attacked Moscow, and they were going to go across the Ukrainian border. And think, Ukraine is at war with Russia. No one's just randomly crossing that border without consequence, and that's going either way. So the fact that they were heading towards this border instead of, say, towards, like, Kazakhstan, again, drawing from the Duran here, since they brought it up, and Russia's border with Kazakhstan and Central Asia is much more loose and, you know, less guarded than the border with Ukraine. And that's because of the customs union, the Eurasian Economic Union, and plus the border is just really, 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 really big. And the population that Russia has over there, that's where Russia's population starts to get a bit sparse and spread out across the vast distances of their, you know, their east. If these people wanted to escape Russia intact, it'd be arguably easier to go that way. Arguably easier. They went through Ukraine. They tried to go through Ukraine. That's the key word. They tried. They were caught by Russian police before they got there. Now, that accusation, in my view, does carry some weight. Now, obviously, the Ukrainians have naturally denied such allegations, and the propaganda press here in the United States has dropped to its knees to suck Ukraine's... to defend them. To defend Ukraine from such ludicrous accusations. Ludicrous in the eyes of anyone who hasn't been observing Ukraine throughout this war. Specifically, Ukraine's behaviors towards Russia. Because, as someone who has been observing them, and I've made note of this a couple times throughout the war, Ukraine, it isn't necessarily fighting a clean war against Russia. For the most part, it is a clean war. Let's not just pretend that the Ukrainians are out there throwing anthrax bombs at the Russians. They're not doing that. But, to the extent that Ukraine fights dirty, this attack here is very much in line with methods that Ukraine would endorse using. It's very much in line. I mean, the Ukrainians have made of themselves in this war not just terrorists, but nuclear terrorists. And I brought that up. They bombed nuclear power plants. They tried to bomb an airbase that had nukes stationed in it. They routinely threatened. They tried to flood. They tried to destroy a dam that, if the water had flooded the region below it, it would have damaged a nuclear reactor in Zaporizhia. And at the beginning of the war, they tried to bomb and use artillery shells on Chernobyl, of all places. They've been using depleted uranium shells on the battlefield. The nuclear terrorism. And then you get to the normal terrorism of sending drone strikes into Moscow and to Belgorod every now and then. You know, you go bomb a building. You go fly two drones in, bomb this area over there. They'd bomb the Kerch Strait Bridge with a truck bomb, if you remember that. Literal acts of terrorism, and then there's acts of nuclear terrorism. So Ukraine fits the bill for both descriptions as a terrorist and a nuclear terrorist state. And with that in mind, with that evidence that I've maintained against the Ukrainians, I can believe Putin's accusation here, based off of previous actions that the Ukrainians have committed towards Russia specifically. And while our media might act as though the idea of being behind this, of Ukraine being behind this attack, is so out of the realm of possibility, it is in actuality completely in line with Ukraine's established pattern of behavior. It's a slight deviation in that Ukraine has never had dudes go into a city and shoot it up, but they're perfectly fine with sending a drone, a kamikaze drone, into Russian buildings where civilians are. They're perfectly fine with a truck bomb on the Kerch Strait Bridge where civilians are. They're perfectly fine flooding a dam and trying to destroy and damage a power plant where civilians are. They're perfectly fine with all this, and they're fine with the damages that are caused by this. Of course, there's also the little drone attacks onto Crimea, specifically Sevastopol, which are usually aimed at the Russian Navy, but not always. And of course, even before that, let us not forget that the Ukrainians sat there for 8 years dropping artillery shells on civilians in the Donbass region. For 8 years, unabetted. Just straight terrorism. No military targets, just straight terrorism on civilian populations. So a whole decade of terrorism is what Ukraine has against it as evidence here, versus the word of themselves and of the propaganda press saying that they would never do something like this. I can believe that Ukraine was involved in this attack. I can 100% believe. Now, just because I can 100% believe it, I'm not going to sit here and say that it was 100% them. We don't know that. We really don't. Like, the only people who would know that are the attackers themselves and theoretically the Ukrainian government if they were involved. But we as regular, we don't know that. We do not know that, but we can believe it. Based on, if we're looking at probabilities, if we're looking at likelihoods, motives, and patterns of behavior, then it is completely believable that Ukraine could have and may have been involved in this attack. Again, look at the bombing of the Kerch Strait Bridge that they've attempted multiple times. It's not just that truck bomb, that's just the biggest example of straight-up terrorism that I can know. It's not just them sending drones into civilian high-rises in Russia. Mm-hmm. It's very much in the realm of possibility. It is very much within the scope of Ukraine's established pattern of behavior. Again, the deviation being that this isn't a drone attack, this isn't a truck bomb, this is dudes on foot, boots on the ground, if you will, shooting up a concert hall. That it hasn't been done before. And that kind of attack on Russia is usually done in the form of these raids into Belgorod. Not that they usually stick to the drones and the missiles and, you know, other kinds of terror. Artillery shells, you know, range. Ukraine usually conducts its terrorism with range. This is up close and personal, which is a different nature. So there is the deviation, right? And that deviation in and of itself could be evidence that it wasn't Ukraine. So we'll throw that out there. That deviation alone means that it could possibly not have been Ukraine. But then why were these attackers moving towards Ukraine to get out of Russia? Why did the Ukrainians, for a very, very brief moment in time, try to say it was a false flag? We don't know. There's a lot we don't know about this attack. There's a lot we don't know. There's going to be people who act like they know, and these people are usually in the U.S. government. they're saying, look.
Excuse me.
They're trying to. They came out immediately in like clockwork. Oh, it's ISIS-K. It's ISIS-K. It's ISIS-K. Well, of course it's ISIS-K. Who else could it have been? It's ISIS-K. It's like, okay, but how would you know that fast? How would you know that? Because your intelligence isn't good enough to tell you how strong the Russian military is. So how would you know that it was ISIS-K doing this attack? How would you know that? Crickets. But our government is acting as if it knows, and you know, maybe it does know, and you know, that in and of itself would carry a lot of connotations, one of which being that perhaps Ukraine was involved, or another of which being that perhaps we were involved, because ISIS-K, oh my god, it's ISIS-K. ISIS-K, like every other terrorist group that you can name, is funded, armed, and trained by the U.S. government. Specifically by the CIA, most of the time. So if it's ISIS-K, Russia can not only retrace that back to Ukraine, if they really wanted to, they could potentially retrace that back to us. Which would incriminate us in a terror attack against Russia. And that is incredibly dangerous. That is, and if we had anything to do with this attack, that would be the most reckless thing we've done so far And we've been really reckless in this war. I hope that we had nothing to do with this, but I just can't trust my federal government. I can't trust the Ukrainians when they said they had nothing to do with this. Their own pattern of behavior suggests otherwise. I have no reason to trust the federal government or any of the buffoons that pass themselves off as statesmen in our country, because they're professional liars who have an obsession, a pathological hatred of Russia. Like, no matter where you look, there's no reason to trust anyone unless you're trusting the Russians. The Russians are somehow the most trustworthy bunch in this whole scenario, which is, you know, something to chew on. They are the victims of the terror attack are the most rational group of actors you're going to find in this terror act. But again, there's a possibility that it was ISIS acting independently of the United States and that Ukraine had nothing to do with it. That is a possibility. We don't know what really went down. I think the probability suggests that Ukraine was involved. I think the probability suggests that we, the United States, were involved as well. That's what the probability suggests to me, but we don't have certainties. So I'm not gonna assert that. But if I were a betting man, yeah. But yeah, this is a really bad attack. If we had anything to do with this, insanely reckless on our part and potentially Ukraine's, if they were involved in this as well. Yeah. Likelihoods, probabilities, motives, patterns, it all points to us in Ukraine, if anybody. Because I don't necessarily know what ISIS-K is going to get out of bombing Russia, other than more trouble in Syria. But again, we'll just have to wait and see as more information about this comes out. But as we move on now, it's very very possible that the United States and Ukraine were involved in this. Ukraine literally just did another one of those cross-border raids into Belgorod. So if I were a betting man, you know what I'd bet on in this case scenario. So all that being said, what is the Russian response, right? Because there's going to be a response. This is too big. Just like that bombing that happened in Turkey in Istanbul, a year or so ago. And they came out immediately pointing the blame at us, the United States, because we fund, arm, and train and support the Kurds who were responsible for that attack. Something similar could happen here. And that attack was so big that they couldn't just sit there and go and, you know, mouth off the pleasantries. Oh, we're going to work with our regional partners to really get this situation under control and come to an amenable resolution with our partners. And that type of language, they couldn't do that. It was too big. It was too consequential. The place that was hit was too important. It was Istanbul. You need a real response. And their real response was to immediately point the finger at the United States, because we fund, arm, and train and support the Kurds who did that bombing. Something similar is going to go down here in Russia. Russia is going to respond to this. We don't know how they're going to respond to this, but they will. That much is certain, because Putin may have just run, he may have just won his re-election, but he's going to have to respond to this for political reasons. He has to respond to this. Everyone in Moscow has to respond to this, because it happened in Moscow, if for no other reason. It happened in Moscow. That means the Russian people are on top of whoever is to blame for the attack. They're gonna look at their own government and say, why didn't you protect us? How did you let this happen? What are you going to do about it? And that kind of political pressure can cause rapid changes in a country's disposition internationally, especially when they're at war, like Russia is, or like they have refused to acknowledge being. They call it a special military operation. The reaction that comes from this, and this is speculation that I'm very much not alone in, but the Duran a number of other actors, Scott Ritter, they are looking at this terror attack, and they're saying Russia is probably going to escalate their special military operation into a formal war, right? Because up until now, the Russians are like, oh, it's a special military operation, oh, the special military operation. They don't call it a war. And there are certain limits that the special military operation has that they have largely adhered to, that they otherwise, that they wouldn't have to adhere to if it was a war from a legal perspective in Russia. They're very, the modern Russia is very anal about doing things by the book and doing things by the law and doing things by the constitution. Their constitution, of course. Special military operation has limitations that a declaration of war does not bring, right? And the talk of the town now is going back to, if you remember, in like the August and winter of 2022, when there was talk of escalating the SMO, special military operation, the SMO, to an anti-terrorism operation or to a formal declaration of war, you know, back when Russia did that first mobilization, there was talk about this sort of escalation back then. Now, with this massive attack, this massive tragic attack on Moscow, 134 people that we know of right now are dead, 100 plus injured. That will not go unanswered by the Russian government. And the most likely avenue for escalation is simply to declare the war. Well, actually, I can't say that it's most likely. I can't say that. We've thought that that was likely before, but we just really don't know what the Russians are going to do. We have no clue what the Russians are going to do. We don't really understand how they behave, if we're being straightforward. Like, I can sit here and speculate, you know, but when it comes down to the nitty-gritty and how they operate, we don't have a proper frame of reference. And even I, after observing them all this time, have I can't predict. I cannot predict the Russian mind. I cannot predict it. So, and the low-hanging fruit would be a better way to put this. The low-hanging fruit for how Russia responds to this is to declare war against Ukraine after they present proper evidence that Ukraine was involved, if Ukraine was involved. Because, again, we don't know that. But if Ukraine was involved, so now we're going to speculate here. If Ukraine was involved, Russia's probably going to have some evidence for that. I mean, Putin stated it matter-of-factly that there was going to be a window open for these people to get into Ukraine, which suggests that either these people had connections on the other side of the border or that the Ukrainian military / government was working in conjunction with these attackers. Now, it doesn't have to be Zelensky. It does not have to be a top-down order from Zelensky. All it takes is one high-ranking member of the Ukrainian military or government or one of their intelligence services to be involved in this in any direct smoking gun way, and the Russians have a case for war. And they can use all the previous abuse, the bombings of the Kerch Strait Bridge, the nuclear terrorism, the various incursions into Belgorod, the bombing of the Donbass for 8 years, the attempted ethnic cleansing against Russians and the Russian language and the Russian culture in the Donbass, the coup in 2014, the refusal to adhere to the Minsk agreements. They could use all of that and just smack it, just dump it onto the table in one fell swoop, and no one's going to be able to say no to that declaration of war. No one's going to be able to argue against a declaration of war that has a decade plus of buildup to it. No one's going to be able to say anything about that. Especially, again, with how patient and measured the Russians have been in their responses up until now. Because, again, if they wanted to annex Ukraine, they could have done so by now. Right? They could have done so, especially with the millions of men that they've mobilized. They could have done so a long time ago. It would have taken them a lot of casualties. They could have done a lot more damage when they first went in than they did. They could have cut the communication. They could have cut off the water. They could have done a lot. They could go full Israel, if so to speak, against the Ukrainians, except the Russians would have a way to actually end the war instead of sitting there and fighting a guerrilla campaign against people in tunnels while you pretend to fight them and just kill the civilians. The Russians have refused to kill civilians for the most, to whatever extent possible, they've refused to kill civilians, which brings us to shocking figures about the comparisons, shocking comparisons between this war and Gaza, where Gaza has a higher civilian casualty count than Ukraine, as far as we know. But the Russians are going to respond. The low-hanging fruit is a declaration of war. We don't know how the Russians are going to respond, but that's the low-hanging fruit. That's the object in everyone's eyes, the shiny object. Although Putin, from what I can tell, likes to be a bit more subtle. He speaks clearly, but his actions are a lot more subtle. I think that that's going to hold true, right? So we don't know the specifics of how they'll respond, but we can sort of, based off of the Russian pattern of behavior, we can assume that their response is going to be much more subtle than what comes to mind for the rest of us, which is a declaration of war against Ukraine. The response is going to be subtle, and we'll have to wait and see what that response is, but there's no way that there's not going to be a response. So there's that. Dmitry Peskov, Russian minister, spokesman, he has come out saying that Russia is at war. Now, he said that, walked it back a little bit, but, you know, that's how he feels. And while he's legally not correct, that could be a sign and an indicator that that's the direction that Russia's going to go in. Again, we don't know. So he's talking about going to war. Putin is talking about, is blaming Ukraine and saying that Ukraine has involvement in this. And now we have to wait and see what the Russian response is. Because they refuse to be at war. They refuse to even declare the war. They refuse to be at war the entire time. That could be a possibility. So, with that as a possibility, what is the other side looking at? Well, the other side is in a really bad position. If Russia does upgrade to a war footing, which they're likely to do, at the bare minimum, they're going to go on an offensive this summer, right? So if the restraints of the military, the special military operation, come off right on the eve of this massive backbreaker offensive that we know is coming. If the restraints of the special military operation are lifted because of this terror attack on Russia, this summer offensive from the Russians is going to be monstrous. It's going to be ruthless. And it's going to be well earned. And no one's going to be able to, no one but the staunchest of Ukraine simps, no one but the most delusional of the deluded are going to be able to say otherwise. And if you're on the other side of this, God help you. God help you. And God help us, because we're on the other side of this. Thankfully, we're on the other side of this and an ocean. And hopefully this doesn't escalate to nuclear war, which I think people in Washington are smart enough not to do. I can guarantee you the Russians aren't going to do it. For all the talk of, Putin, because throughout the war you've heard the Putin, he could use a tactical nuke. He could do it. And this is namely Temple I'm talking about. What can I say? It's, you know. Oh, Putin could use a nuke. He has not yet begun to fight. He could use a tactical nuke. But it's not just him. Or it's not just Temple. I won't pretend that it's just him. There's been a lot of talk. You see the articles about, all these cities that Russia would target in a war between the United States. And all this talk about Russia using nukes, when the Russians aren't going to be the ones using nukes. They've demonstrated that much. And plus, they want to protect themselves. They're not going to nuke a country right next to themselves and then have to live with the fallout, the literal fallout from that. They're not going to do that. And half of Ukraine is populated by Russians. They're not going to nuke Russians. And more than that, they don't consider Ukrainian to be a proper ethnicity. They consider Ukrainians to be Russian.
So they're definitely not going to nuke people that they consider to be Russians. It's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. They have no reason or intent or ideologically, militarily, or tactically, strategically, or otherwise to drop nukes on Ukraine. Now, if you're NATO and you're losing a proxy war against a country that you thought you were going to be able to destroy, if you're NATO and you've emptied your arsenals and you are now at the mercy of this country that you've been antagonizing for decades, and we're not just talking about modern Russia, we're talking about the Soviet Union too. This country that you've been antagonizing for a century. If you're NATO, you're going to be the one thinking about using nukes. You're going to be the one thinking about dropping a nuclear wall between you and the Russians, a wall of fallout that the Russians won't pass. If you're in NATO and you realize that the writing is on the wall, Trump is coming back, globalism's coming to an end, the multipolar world is rising and challenging the hegemony of the power structure based in the United States, and the Russians are winning the war in Ukraine, and you have no weapons, and you have nothing, and you're bankrupt, trillions of dollars in debt, you're going to be the one thinking about using a nuclear weapon. And it's this desperation that I talked about with Macron, him being the representative of this desperation, this growing desperation, which is going to get more dangerous as we approach the end of this war. We are very much in the end game right now. Talked about Russia's going to respond, and it's going to be biblical for the Ukrainians. And all this at the same time that the $61 billion aid package for Ukraine is being held hostage in Congress, as it should. It shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be there at all, but if it's going to be there, it better be held hostage, and it better not pass. $61 billion for Ukraine, not going anywhere in Congress. All this at the same time that reports are coming out that Ukraine is on the verge of running out of air defense missiles between now and April. With some suggesting that they're out already. All this at the same time that France and Poland, again going back to Macron, are talking about sending troops into Ukraine. Oh, but they're only going to fulfill auxiliary positions in the back lines. They're going to guard the border with Belarus so that Ukraine can put more of its troops on the front line. You know, because Ukraine is winning, okay? Ukraine is winning. That's why they need us. That's why they need us to guard their border with Belarus so that they can win harder on the battlefield, on the front line, and use more troops to win more, you know? Or that they're losing really, really badly, which is what the former chief of the Polish general staff, Rajmund Andrzejczyk, I think that's how you pronounce it, he said that he believes, quote, and he is retired, so take this with a grain of salt, he says, quote, losses should be counted in the millions, and he's talking about Ukraine's losses. So let me repeat that. Quote, losses should be counted in the millions, not the hundreds of thousands, end quote. He also said that there are no resources in this country, no one left to fight. And he says that the Ukrainians are losing the war. Those are all quotes. Millions and not the hundreds of thousands. So Ukraine has 500,000 dead. Now, if, and that was months ago that they crossed that threshold, so it's likely that they're 600,000, 700,000, perhaps. And throughout the war, half of their casualties have been deaths. So you're looking at 1 million, 1.2 million, 1.4 million casualties with the death rates that the Ukrainians usually have that we know of. If there's been a major divergence between, injured between the casualty rate and the fatality rate. If within the casualties, if the fatality rate has been dropping in Ukraine while deaths are still just climbing astronomically, then that would mean a lot more men and women are being injured and just, you know, not being able to be sent back to the front line. Which would suggest a real casualty tally that is in the millions plural, potentially. We don't know, but this is what this guy's saying. And that would make a good deal of sense considering the pressure that's being put onto Ukraine to pass this mobilization bill, to mobilize the young people, as Lindsey Graham wants, going over there and trying to get them to pass this bill to mobilize 21 to 27-year-olds. Mobilize them. Mobilize them all. Go die against the Russians. This is the year of offense. I mean, think of how sick these people are. He's going to go over there and tell them to sacrifice the only hope that Ukraine has left of existing as a nation state. The young men. Go die on the front line against the Russians. Throw away your future as a nationality that exists in Europe. Like, what is happening? This is all desperation. It's all desperation. Let's send troops into Ukraine. That's desperation. Please, let's get the money passed for Ukraine. That was the beginning of the desperation, right? We're going to get this aid because they were all confident. They were all cocky. You know, they thought they were going to get it through. Didn't get through. And now it's... Now the fearmongering started to kick in about 2 months ago. Oh my God, this is urgent. Ukraine needs this, and they're just getting more and more belligerent about how Ukraine needs this money. Ukraine's not getting the money. France and Poland are talking about sending. Well, they are sending. If this talk is indicative of anything, they look like they are sending troops. They look like they are. NATO's out. NATO's being outproduced by the Russians, according to CNN. NATO's being outproduced 3-1 in artillery shells. That news is coming out now. We weren't allowed to know that before. That'd have been nice to know before the war began. The rates of production. What the Russian military industrial machine was capable of. That'd have been nice to know. It's the desperation has really begun to set in here. This attack on Moscow is going to be the justification, perhaps the final nail in the coffin for Ukraine. If Ukraine was involved, again, we don't know that. But I highly suspect that they are. And if so, this attack is also indicative of the increasing desperation and increasing feralness of NATO in this attempt at destroying Russia, which has gone so badly that they're destroying themselves in the process. And it's only going to get worse from here, because that backbreaker offensive is coming. It's almost April right now. It's getting a little warm out. It's pretty soon it's gonna be May. Then it's gonna be June. It's coming. They know it's coming. And they may have just given Russia the perfect excuse to lift the restraints of the special military operation just ahead of the backbreaker offensive. And that means, it means that the obvious is going to be made clear for everyone to see. That Ukraine can't win the war. And people are going to see just how badly the odds were stacked against Ukraine from the start when this offensive comes. When the Ukrainian lines collapse, which is, again, going back to way back at the beginning of this episode, when the French talking to the news stations about getting ready for the collapse of Ukraine, this is what they're talking about. Casualties measured in the millions is probably what they're talking about. Casualties measured in the millions. Desperation to get them to mobilize. Why? Because everyone's either dead or dying. Injured and can't fight. That's why you need more. Because they don't all have to be dead. They just have to be taken out of service. And you need to fill those positions with new, fresh blood. Mobilize. Mobilize your young folk. Please get the $61 billion through Congress. Ukraine needs it. Please. It's all desperation. It's all desperation. And I think Ukraine is going to be put out of its misery the very, very, very hard way. The old Yeller way, to put it simply. And it is sad. It is a tragedy. Because it truly did not have to be this way. But I think that the people running this show, these Russophobes who have nothing better to do with their lives than to sit there and hate Russia, they have made this bed and they're going to sleep in it. And unfortunately, Ukraine will never awaken from that slumber.